NATO says it does not seek war, but is ready for it. Its foreign ministers have met to discuss the conflict in Ukraine. But will the alliance get involved? And if it does, what will be the consequences? This is Inside Story. Welcome to the program. I'm Darina Abugaido. The Russian invasion of Ukraine is now in its second week, and there's no sign of a let-up. Friday saw the attack on Europe's largest nuclear facility by Russian forces in Ukraine. The site caught fire before being put out. It sparked worldwide condemnation and fears of a catastrophic radiation leak. NATO foreign ministers have met in Brussels for a special summit on Ukraine. The alliance has imposed more sanctions on the Russian leader Vladimir Putin and his inner circle. And the U.S. is going after business leaders who are closely tied to the Kremlin. But none of this appears to be swaying Putin into pulling back his troops. The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says NATO does not want confrontation with Moscow, but it stands ready if conflict comes. While the head of the alliance condemned Russia's attack on the nuclear sites as reckless.
We condemn the attacks on civilians, and over the night we have also seen reports about the attack against a nuclear power plant. This just demonstrates the recklessness of this war and the importance of ending it and the importance of Russia withdrawing all its troops and engaging good faith in diplomatic efforts.
Every ally, in one way or another, is coming to Ukraine's assistance. Every ally, in one way or another, is helping to strengthen NATO itself. And as the Secretary General said, ours is a defensive alliance. We seek no conflict. But if conflict comes to us, we're ready for it. And we will defend every inch of NATO territory.
We'll bring in our guests in a moment. But first, let's look at why Ukraine has long been a particularly sensitive issue for Moscow. It was part of the Russian Empire before becoming a Soviet republic and then winning independence in 1991 when the Soviet Union collapsed. Moscow has since been concerned with keeping Ukraine out of NATO. Vladimir Putin says the West promised in the past NATO wouldn't expand eastwards. But since 1997, 14 more countries have joined the alliance, mainly in the east. There were tensions 8 years ago when mass protests toppled the Ukrainian president Viktor Yanukovych. He'd pushed for closer ties to Moscow rather than the EU. Well, Russia's armed forces responded by annexing the Crimean Peninsula and backing a separatist rebellion in eastern Ukraine. Let's now bring in our guest. Joining us from Brussels is Brooks Tigner, who's the correspondent for Jane's Defense Weekly magazine. In Washington, D.C., Robert Hunter, a former U.S. ambassador to NATO. Joining us from Moscow, Andrei Baklanov, who's the chairman of the board of the Association of Russian Diplomats. Thank you so much for your time with us on Inside Story. Ambassador Robert, over to you. Jens Stoltenberg has just said that NATO is not part of the conflict. NATO is a defensive alliance. We don't seek war or conflict with Russia. But the longer this goes on, what does NATO do then?
The NATO commitment under Article 5 of the Treaty of Washington is to defend countries that are formally members of the alliance. And everybody in NATO is trying to get across to Mr. Putin that whatever happens in Ukraine, and I'm sure we're going to be talking about that, he'd better not make any mistake that, as to put it by the American Secretary of State, any Russians coming into any NATO countries, NATO, including the United States, is ready to respond. So it's going to be a very firm defense of all NATO allies if it comes to that. At the same time, while a number of NATO countries are providing weaponry to the Ukrainians, no NATO country is prepared to go to war for Ukraine, which is not a NATO member.
All right. Brooks, over to you. Do you share the same point of view as the ambassador does? I mean, what does NATO do if this continues? The war on Ukraine. We've seen all sort of unprecedented reaction so far, including, of course, the sanctions on Russia, as well as, for the first time, the purchase and delivery of weapons to Ukraine itself.
Well, yes, I agree with what Robert said all the way down the line on the policy and the Article 5 issues. If Russia continues its aggression and the threat perception increases on NATO's part, what can it do? Well, it has to do more of what it's already done, which he effectively just described, both Robert and the Secretary General. But also, I think if they are going to help Ukraine, even though they can't fly their jets there and put any boots on the ground, they need to step up their weapons transfers, which are not necessarily very speedy, given that they've got to go across land primarily. Russia's blocking most of the sea access. So indeed, I just asked the SecGen this question in his press conference, you know, should NATO consider setting up a more permanent structure for moving weapons, of coordinating bilateral transfers among the weapons? NATO itself doesn't transfer weapons, of course, but the EU is doing this with Poland. It seems to me it would make sense to at least set up a standing structure that's more than ad hoc, either that rotates among the allies as the coordinator or is coordinated by NATO. But the Secretary General seemed to suggest that's not on the table for the time being.
Since you were in that press conference, let me just get one more question to you, Brooks, and that is the calls by the Ukrainian president, I'm sure you've heard, for NATO to enforce a no-fly zone. Now, this is something that the Secretary General has come out and said that is not going to happen. He's ruled out that idea. The Lithuanian prime minister describing it as irresponsible. Do you think that NATO is going to stick to this?
It has to, unless it wants war. I mean, to set up a no-fly zone and enforce it over the skies of Ukraine would put allied troops and equipment and weapons directly in conflict with those of Russia. And that would be war. So simple answer, no.
All right. Andrei, over in Moscow, over the last weeks, this is according to NATO, in fact. What they're saying is that they have increased their presence in the eastern part of the alliance. And for the first time, they are deploying the NATO response force with French troops now arriving in Romania. This is quite unprecedented. With NATO building up its military, how is this being perceived by the Kremlin?
Actually, there is nothing special in these facts because this is the prolongation of the many years of the NATO policy. They are bringing closer and closer their military infrastructure to our territory. There were 14 members of the bloc. Now they are having 30 members of the bloc. And officially, if we studied the documents of NATO, they officially are attributing the word enemy to us. What we have now for the more than 20 years, NATO is coming closer and closer to our cities, to our centers of industrial might. This is very dangerous. We remember the lessons of 1941 when Hitler attacked us, and we are not going to make the same mistakes as we did before the Second World War, when we were very cautious not to start war, but we were trying to do our utmost not to have war. But it was in vain. And now we are warning the West not to come closer and closer to us. This is too dangerous to ourselves, and we will defend ourselves, which we already started in the process of denazification over Ukraine. We are calling this liberation. Me personally,
right, but the rest, right, but the Western, right,
there.
Right, but let me just jump in there. I mean, because another word to describe it, yeah, as we've seen by Western countries as well as the United States and NATO, is that they are in fact describing this as an invasion, Andrei Baklanov. But let me put some of what you had to say to Robert Hunter over in Washington. Your response to the comments out of Russia. And also, let me just ask you this. I mean, in January, the U.S. Secretary of State said that NATO's door is open. It remains open. And that is our commitment, knowing full well that this is something that bothers Russia. To what extent has this open door policy maximized friction with Russia, Ambassador, and as a result, has culminated in this current crisis?
I can understand the concern in Russia about not having Ukraine be a member of NATO, which isn't going to happen. At the same time, if you're talking about 1941 and Operation Barbarossa, in which the Nazis went into the Soviet Union, The Operation Barbarossa now is being conducted by Russia against another country. And if there's any parallel with the Nazis, it's in the Kremlin today. Ironically, Soviet Union fought for 2.5 years to keep the Nazis out of the Kremlin, and now they're there in the Kremlin causing conflict. There was no justification whatsoever for what Russia is doing. NATO, no NATO country, not Ukraine, which is not a NATO country, is posing any threat whatsoever to Russia. Mr. Putin knows it. He's, for whatever reason, using forms of words to justify an aggressive military action, unprecedented since what the Russians call the Great Patriotic War.
All right.
So if Mr. Putin is concerned, he can just stop, negotiate, and get everybody from Russia back out.
Here's the thing. Let's just pause for a moment. The war in Ukraine follows decades of warnings that NATO expansion into Eastern Europe could actually provoke Russia. And this is from the CIA director, William J. Burns. He'd been warning about it since 1995, saying this: hostility to early NATO expansion is almost universally felt across the domestic political spectrum here. And when President Bill Clinton's administration moved to bring Poland, Hungary and the Czech Republic into NATO, he said the decision was premature at best and needlessly provocative at worst. So there have been warnings about this in the past. Brooke Stigner, should we not be surprised that things have gotten to this point?
Well, I'm not sure I fully agree with that. Let's remember that when the Soviet Union
agree with the statement that was made by the CIA director, which has been echoed, in fact, by others, including Henry Kissinger in a 2014 opinion piece.
Of course, so what? But that doesn't mean a journalist can contest it, and I do, for the following reason. When the Soviet Union fell apart and when the Warsaw Pact fell apart, let's remember that these countries on their own chose to join NATO. The way our Russian speaker has framed the issue is that it's as if NATO belligerently expanded eastward. It didn't. There was a process. It's the path, as we've heard NATO officials say over and over again, it is the democratic and independent choice of each country to join the alliance. These countries asked to join. If they weren't interested in joining NATO, they wouldn't have, and then what do you end up? You end up with a no man's land, a strip of land running down north, south through Europe, which I suppose Russia would have liked to be permanent. But these countries did not want that permanent status. They asked to join NATO. You could argue that maybe NATO could have waited longer than 1997 to let them in, another 5 or 10 years to massage relations with Russia. But on the other hand, there was a lot of pressure from these East European capitals to join NATO, and perhaps they had a reason for doing so.
Andrei, would you like to respond?
Yes. First of all, I'd like to underline the fact which our friends in the United States are ignoring. Fact is that the present-day government and the rulers of in Kyiv, they came originally in 2014 as a coup d'etat, illegal coup d'etat. This is the first fact. Okay, coup d'etat can happen, but it's a coup d'etat of very specific nature. And the people now occupying the key positions, they are Nazi. So we think that a present-day campaign, this is the prolongation of our war, which we had against the Nazi Germany. Nazi Germany and the whole Europe backed. We remember that all the Europe were occupied, and the ruling circles very willingly helped this Nazi Germany, and they made 60% of the necessary equipment for the German aggressive army. We remember these facts about the behavior of the covert
Right, but I'd really like to keep this discussion focused on today's events.
So this is anti-Nazi. This is anti-Nazi.
I'd really like to keep the discussion focused on today's events. Ambassador Robert Hunter, weigh in, please, because I see you shaking your head.
Well, if anybody is behaving like Nazi Germany, today it's Mr. Putin. I don't know whether he has a lot of support in his own country, but this is an invasion of a sovereign country which posed zero threat to Russia or to anybody else. NATO has never invaded any European country that the Russians could possibly care about. NATO got involved in Bosnia and Kosovo because of the incredibly bad things that were happening there. In fact, the Russians supported what NATO and the West did in Bosnia, and then sent troops to the implementation force. But there is absolutely no justification at all for what Russia is now doing.
But what do you make of the argument, Ambassador, that Russia feels like its security is in fact threatened? Because we have seen activities in that particular region, such as war games with American tanks staged in nearby Baltic states. We have rockets stationed in both Poland and Romania. And Russia sees this as a threat to its security.
If you're asking me,
yes, I am.
That happened after the invasion of Crimea and the Donbass region in 2014. And remember, up until then, there has been the NATO-Russia Founding Act. Russia was involved in the council with NATO as an equal at Brussels, could have continued that. But instead, Mr. Putin decided in 2014 to seize a chunk of Europe. And that was uncalled for, unprovoked. There is no threat from NATO. Nobody can possibly call what anything NATO has done as a provocation to Russia. Whatever Mr. Putin has in mind, that's only in his mind. But he is an aggressor state. And one of the problems that's coming out of this is there's no Western state, including the United States, that will ever again be able to deal with Mr. Putin. If Russia wants to have a healthy relationship, Russia's going to have to take care of its own leadership.
We're going to discuss that also in a moment. I'd like to get your take on what happens next. But first, Brooks Tignor, if you can just give us some context to this, because why would NATO want to move east in the first place? You know, since 1997, 14 more countries have joined the alliance, mainly in the east.
Well, it's not that NATO wanted, I repeat what I said earlier, it's not that NATO wanted to move east, it's the fact that there were countries in the eastern part of Europe that asked to join NATO. So therefore, there was an organic expansion. There was no great game plan to all of a sudden expand NATO's entire frontier eastward. It just happened step by step. As for some of these exercises that our Russian speaker has referred to, I mean, Robert Hunter had a point. Most of these prior to 2014 Crimea, most of these exercises were notified by both sides quite diligently under the CFE, the Conventional Forces in Europe convention or treaty. So everyone knew what everyone was doing. But since then, things have become much more ambiguous as both sides try to figure out what the other is doing. The notifications haven't taken place, certainly from the Russian side. So you can interpret whether NATO is having more aggressive military exercises in the East as you like. But I will say for one other thing on the propaganda front, or at least on the language that's coming out of Russia, to characterize Ukraine's political leadership as Nazis and that Russia needs to denazify Ukraine is just outrageous. It has really inflamed most of the Ukrainians I know. And it's a great irony to accuse the country's president of being a Nazi when, in fact, I think Mr. Zelensky has lost family members during the Holocaust and in the Second World War. So this kind of language is not helping relations at all.
Andrei Baklanov, the Secretary General of NATO, Stoltenberg, has said that NATO entering the fighting in Ukraine could lead to widespread war in Europe. I mean, looking ahead, what is the view from Russia about what happens next in the coming days and weeks ahead?
First of all, I'd like to react a little bit.
For the sake of time, Andrei Baklanov, I'd really appreciate an answer to my question. Let's look ahead and tell me what you think will happen.
Actually, we are very much nervous about the mercenaries coming from Europe. They are sending approximately 16,000 mercenaries there, and also new armaments coming to the hands of these Nazi elements. And the Minister of Foreign Affairs yesterday reacted to this thing, and they said that again and again in 20th century and now in 21st century, German, for instance, are sending the armaments to kill Russians.
But what is Putin's end game with the war in Ukraine?
Well, actually, we came to the point where it's necessary to do something. You know that in Munich a few weeks ago, the so-called president of Ukraine, he claimed that Ukraine will acquire atomic weapons. Well, we made impossible for the Nazi Germany to acquire this because we in 1945.
Andrei Bakunov, but with all due respect, he is the president of Ukraine. He is the elected president of Ukraine. So I don't think we can call him the so-called president. But let me go over to Robert Hunter in Washington. Ambassador Hunter, just before we end the show, just tell me how you see this playing out.
Well, that really is up to Mr. Putin, because we have said in the West, beginning with the United States, that we will not get involved in this conflict, even though it is an aggressive action against a sovereign country to which, in 1994, Russia, along with Britain and the United States, in exchange for Ukraine giving up nuclear weapons, a solemn commitment to protect the border of Ukraine, not to do anything against Ukraine, and also to Belarus and to Kazakhstan. They have broken that commitment. No matter what has happened on the Western side, Russia has put itself in a position of an aggressor nation. If Mr. Putin wants to stop now, arrangements can be worked out so that, as we tried back in the 1990s, Russia can be a full participant in an overall European security effort. Mr. Putin decided he didn't want it, and he has now put himself in a situation where he's damaged his country, for a long time to come. Short-term sanctions are one thing. Long-term isolation from the outside world. He is damning his own people to go through the terrible deprivations they went through in the Cold War.
All right. And final word over to you, Brooke Stigner. There's been a lot of diplomatic activity where you are, in particular in Brussels. How do nations sort of dial back? How does everybody dial back from this? And how do you foresee this playing out over the next days and weeks ahead?
Well, I don't think there will be much of a way to dial back things diplomatically. That's been the main plea of the Western nations, which has fallen on deaf ears in Moscow. As for how this might play out, I won't speculate about Mr. Putin's end game, but I will speculate about his tactics. It would make sense if he cannot conquer physically the entire country that he would probably pull back and hold the areas that he has, and then use the same tactics, the same approach that he did with the Donbass, get the people in there, move some people in there in order to support him, declare them as republics, then absorb the territories eventually into Russia. I wouldn't be surprised if that was his plan.
All right, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us, Brooke Stigner, Robert Hunter, and Andrei Baklinov. We really appreciate your time with us. Thank you for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. For further discussion, you can go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. Join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is AJInsideStory. Myself and the whole team here in Doha, thanks for watching, and bye-bye for now.